We're talking about the teams who have tried to build their offensive lines the Cowboys way, whether the Chiefs can ever break through in the AFC, whether the Seahawks' championship window might be closed, and what in the world is going on with Todd Gurley. All that and more on this week's edition of the MMQB 10 Things Podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. I'm here with Andy Benoit, and we are going to continue our trip through the league, sort of, post-free agency, pre-draft, see what teams need, talk about some bigger trends around the league, and we'll have a good time doing it.
I'm looking forward to it, and guess what happened to me again, Gary, following up on last week's show?
Oh, man, this better be about a sweatpants here.
I got seen. Well, I didn't get seen because I haven't met him, but I saw an NFL coach who I know through email but haven't met in person. I saw him in the airport, and I was in sweatpants, so I did not go up and say hello. So that's five out of seven trips, my last trips. I've been in unspeakable sweatpants. I now have bought a nicer pair of sweats.
Oh my god, I just had to take my headset off for a second. I'm playing hurt, by the way. I know it's NFL podcasting and everyone plays hurt, but that just gave me a coughing fit because I was laughing so hard.
Really?
I had to pull my headset off.
Okay, yeah, because we didn't hear the coughing fit. If I didn't know better, I'd say you didn't care at all for the story. Oh boy.
There you go. And then that story almost literally killed me. That's how good it was. I'm just so glad we talked sweatpants again. And we got it, we got it right out at the top of the show where, the sweatpants fans sort of get it early on, and now they're engaged and they're ready for some football talk.
We've
taken a trip through some of the teams drafting toward the top of the draft. We're going to talk about a lot of playoff teams this week. And I actually wanted to talk about a little discussion here because this was a heavy topic of discussion, especially early last season. Everyone looks at the Dallas Cowboys and says, that's how you build a team. Why doesn't everyone build a team like that? Get great offensive linemen and then everything else takes care of itself. And I want to talk about two teams who have clearly tried to do that. They've taken offensive linemen very early in the draft. And that's the New York Giants and the Miami Dolphins. I mean, they have spent early picks on offensive linemen here. And I actually want to start with the Dolphins because I think the Dolphins are kind of close to breaking through. I think if they can find maybe one more guy, I think they have a star in Tunsil who's going to play left tackle. I think Mike Pouncey, granted, he's not always healthy here, but I think he's a stud in the middle of that line. And I think they add one more guy, and with Jay Ajayi running behind that, I think they're close to having, I shouldn't say close, but I think they're closest to basically building the way the Cowboys are built.
Yeah, because they also took Juwan James in the first round in 2014 at right tackle. Now, he has not quite played up to that level, but
yeah. The
point is, you're right, they're building that team intentionally. Three of their five starting linemen are first-round picks, and everybody but the guards are first-round picks. It's interesting, Gary, because the Giants are like this as well, and the Dolphins, now they didn't have Adam Gase when they were making some of these decisions.
Yes.
Pouncey and James predate Adam Gase. But in that scheme, where the ball is out so quickly, I always struggle with how important are the offensive linemen really. Obviously, you want good ones, but keep in mind, everything comes at a cost, and left tackles especially are extremely expensive. Centers can be expensive if you get at the very top echelon, which you do with Mike Pouncey. And so is it worth it if the ball's getting thrown in two and a half seconds? Look at the Patriots, for example, and they have Nate Solder, so they did pay a left tackle as well, but everyone else, they're always plugging in young guys and, for the most part, getting away with it. And I don't – it's the argument against it, because I think it's not worth it, is my position. I don't think it's worth these big investments, not when you consider how expensive the positions are. But the argument you always get against it is the alternative is your offense short-circuiting. The downside is so low. If your offensive line is a liability, you can't play. And the Dolphins have learned that the hard way as well in recent years. So it's offensive linemen are really just an extremely expensive insurance policy in a lot of systems. Dallas, it's different. They have a different style of offense. But for these quick strike teams, offensive line's an insurance policy.
Though it's also, if you're going to build a team that's going to be based, going to be built around the run game, which, you know, the Dolphins are in sort of a, they're in sort of a no man's land with Ryan Tannehill. I don't think anyone's looking at Ryan Tannehill and saying like, oh yeah, this is the guy. This is the guy who's going to carry us to a championship. So they're doing it a little bit differently. Because at the same time, Tannehill isn't a guy you're going to say, oh, he can't play, we better upgrade. He's like the, you know, whatever, he's the 16th to 24th best quarterback in football.
Yeah. Well, and this, it's going to be a big year for Ryan Tannehill. This is probably his make-or-break year in Miami. And there are people around the league who thought Gase did not trust him last season. And they thought that because of the way Gase called and the way he used Tannehill in certain scenarios. So we'll find out. And the Dolphins certainly found their footing when they became more of a run-oriented offense last year. And Ajayi's a good workhorse back, but let's also keep in mind, Ajayi had a lot of highs and lows himself. Mm-hmm. His numbers are a little bit inflated by the way he dominated the Bills, and I think it was one other team he went off on. Was it the Steelers midseason?
Yep.
So he had some huge games. He was not a sustaining week-to-week dominant player. And Adam Gase does not believe strongly in the running game. He'd rather throw short passes than run the ball. So by no means are the Dolphins and their identity established this season. They could very well look like a totally different team after this season because I think they're still figuring out who they are.
You think so?
Yeah, because they don't. They're figuring out Tannehill.
Yeah.
And I know their record was very good, and that's going to factor in. And if they start out 7-2 or something like that, then this discussion probably goes out the window. But anytime you have a newer coach, an offensive-minded coach who has a very specific philosophy, and Gase does, you know, he's humble enough to play to his team's strengths, which is why he ran the ball last year. But he's a passing coach, and they don't quite know what they have in their quarterback yet under that new head coach. That's a team that's in flux.
Hmm. Well, how about the Giants? The Giants have drafted guys early on the offensive line, and it hasn't worked out as well. It seems like offensive line is always an issue for them. Basically, what do they do with this offense at this point? Because they sort of run the same stagnant thing the last couple of years. It looks like they're going to roll with Paul Perkins maybe as the lead back there in the backfield. I'm not sure how this offense is built at this point.
It's going to be a passing offense. They're a three wide receiver offense. They are simplified in what they do. They don't have a ton of different formations. They'll move their receivers around, but they're not doing a lot of shifting or pre-snap motion. They are another team that wants to get the ball out quickly. And they for sure do not need big-time pass-blocking offensive linemen because of the nature of their offense. But we have seen the damage that Ereck Flowers can do at left tackle, so there are times where you do need to rely on your linemen, and those guys, that offensive line, has not been as reliable as you want. But the interesting part of it is, okay, so we don't need great pass-blocking linemen, but you ask Gary, what's the issue with this offense? They have a very limited running game. It's a simplified north and south running game, a lot of double-team blocks in between the tackle runs, and if you're going to play that way, having a good offensive line helps a lot because right now they don't have a running back that can create his own yards. So where does the run game come from? They don't have a great line and they don't have a great dimensional running back. And that's the issue with this offense. And it was a problem for him last year, and I could see it being an issue again this season.
Yeah. I don't know. It looks like it's going to be more of the same. I guess you're a little more dynamic with Brandon Marshall joining the receiving core.
Well, yeah, you do get Marshall, and I think what's going to be interesting, because this team does not have they need to improve on offense, but they don't have a ton of needs. They need a tight end, and that's about the only dire need they have. I guess you could argue they need a running back, but I think it starts with the offensive line. And could we find a scenario where the Giants take the best offensive lineman on the board? Because if you go through their spots, Justin Pugh at left guard, he's probably set there, but you could move him around. Richburg at center's probably set, but then the other spots, Eric Flowers needs to be replaced at left tackle. I know he's their first-round pick in 2015. He can't play. He needs to be replaced. And then at right tackle, Bobby Hart's just a guy. So both tackle spots are open, and John Jerry at right guard could be replaced. So when you factor that in and you have versatile linemen at the other spots, I think they could take the best offensive lineman on the board if they wanted to with their first-round pick.
All right. I want to move on and transition kind of clumsily. I want to talk in very vague terms about two teams here. And we'll start with the Kansas City Chiefs. You know, the Chiefs have been sort of on the verge of being a breakthrough team, but something's missing. And is it as simple to you as they kind of just need better quarterback play?
It's yes and no. The yes part is I do think Alex Smith was not good in the playoff game against Pittsburgh, and that happens. I mean, it's keep in mind, let's say that bad day had been October 20th instead of January 20th or whenever it was. That's a whole, now we're having a different discussion. So is it a coincidence? We don't know. But he, you could say he was, I don't want to say he's the reason they lost to the Steelers, but you could say he's the reason they did not win against the Steelers. There were opportunities there to be had. But they're also there, what, they're hosting the playoff game. It was a second-round game, if I recall. And so they can get to a certain level with Smith. And I have trouble saying, well, with Alex Smith, you can get to the divisional round, but that's it. Like, I don't know if football works that way. You win the divisional round, now you got to the championship with Alex Smith. It's a week-to-week league and a week-to-week proposition. So I don't know if it's that simple, Gary. They're such a well-schemed offense as well. And Alex Smith, what he always will do well is run the offense for the most part. He'll run it the way it's designed to be run in its simplest form.
I mean, is it just sort of a matter of this is an Andy Reid team and an Andy Reid offense, and they do the Andy Reid thing well, but it's not good enough to get past a league that has Tom Brady in it?
Maybe, but that offense doesn't play against Tom Brady. That offense plays against New England's defense, and it plays against Pittsburgh's defense and Houston's defense. And it is good enough to beat those teams. It's done it before. I guess it hasn't beaten New England, but we're talking theoretically now. It can be very well schemed, and they have a defense that has some playmakers on it. So do they have a Super Bowl quarterback in and of himself? No, but that doesn't mean they're not a Super Bowl team. If you're not great at quarterback, it means you have to be exceptional in a lot of other areas. And Kansas City, you could argue, is exceptional in a lot of other areas.
All right. It's just, you get the sense it's just getting to that point where it's, I don't know, you're getting a little bit fidgety, you're getting a little bit panicky if you're a Chiefs fan these days. Like, are you ever going to get over the top?
Yeah, the ceiling's been hit almost, is kind of what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, what'll be different this? Well, real quick, what's going to be different this year? And I think it's important enough that let's take a wait and see. Is Tyreek Hill's going to become an every down player for them? And he might be a bona fide superstar when you consider the things he can do that other guys can't do. That doesn't mean he'll always have those kind of numbers, but the way you have to defend him and account for him, he might have that kind of impact on him. So I'm eager to see. And when you plug in a player like that in a scheme that has as much deception and misdirection as Kansas City's does, they now have perfect conditions for what they want to do if Tyreek Hill becomes that guy for them. So maybe we take a wait and see after this season.
You know, speaking of superstars, as long as we're on the subject of Chiefs superstars, you know, they kind of did it without Justin Houston a year ago. Is this a team that needs a pass rush? It's funny, you look at the Final Four last year, and let's throw the Cowboys in there too, because the Cowboys obviously were that caliber team. None of those teams had a great pass rush, and really, if you look at the rosters, Vic Beasley is the only guy who you could really look at and say, among those five teams, is a great pass rusher.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. Pittsburgh didn't have a great edge rusher anywhere. They feel they need one. New England never has one because they invest in defensive tackles instead of defensive ends, and the reason for that is defensive tackles are much cheaper. Dallas, you just covered. Kansas City, their guys were less than 100%. Remember, late in the year, Dee Ford was not himself either, and he totally disappeared after a great start to the season. So there are a lot of quality teams, and Vic Beasley was the only guy in Atlanta, and I would almost guarantee that's an anomaly, doesn't it? I mean, I find that one hard to correlate to anything other than just weird circumstance, because we know the pass rush is hugely important in the NFL.
Is it becoming less important because you have a lot of teams and a lot of good teams are getting the ball out quickly?
Oh, sure. Yes, absolutely. But remember, it's always going to be third and long at some point in an NFL game. And those are usually the big points in the game. How those third and long plays go dictates how the whole game goes. And in third and long, pass rush, there's no way to account for it. It's man versus man a lot of the times.
All right. I do want to talk about a team with a pass rush here, and that is the Seattle Seahawks. And I feel like the last 2 years, we sort of reached a point in November or December where we've all kind of thought, you know what, Seahawks are the best team in the NFC. Seahawks are going to go to the Super Bowl again. And obviously they haven't gotten back there each of the last 2 years. Are we starting to look at a point where maybe the Seahawks window has closed?
I don't think we're there yet, but we are at the point where we can start discussing when will the window close. They have a lot of big-time star players, and those guys are right in the heart of their prime right now. We're talking, Gary, it always fascinates me, and this is why I remember we asked, Greg Cosell and I asked Dan Quinn this question once. We texted him when we were watching Seahawks film, because we thought how you answer this question kind of reveals everything about how you view defense and what's important on defense. And the question was, who is the most valuable player on your defense? Because when you go through, there are seven guys that you could say are top five in the league at their position. That'd be Michael yeah. Bennett, Cliff Averill, Bobby Wagner, KJ Wright as an outside linebacker, Richard Sherman at cornerback. This was 2 years ago in the Dan Quinn question. Mm-hmm. And then Cam Chancellor and Earl Thomas. And so when you say, well, who's the most important guy there, you're really saying what's the most important part of a defense, because this is a simple scheme with immense talent at every level of it. And all these guys, though, Gary, that we're talking about, these seven guys, they're all still in their late 20s.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously the big rumor has been Sherman, and is Sherman going to get dealt, and you know, he'd go in the right deal type of thing, which I guess is technically true with just about anyone who's not a quarterback in this league.
Yeah.
You know, you wrote about Sherman, and you said he was a little bit, he was not the same guy on in-breaking routes last year. Obviously, he had that, you know, it came out, he had that undisclosed MCL injury. Could you chalk it up to that, or are we looking, do you get the sense that we're looking at an aging player?
We'll find out. I have no idea. I'd only be guessing, but that's, he was clearly not as good whenever he had to change directions last year. He's still maybe the best in the league at covering vertical routes along the sideline. If you go north and south on Sherman, his ball tracking ability mixed with his physicality, he's extremely difficult to play against. But if you make him have to change directions, which is what you said, in breaking routes, so slant routes, dig routes, anything where the receiver cuts at an angle, Sherman was not the same guy last year. And I would imagine, I've never had an MCL injury, but Gary, wouldn't you think that would factor into it? I could very well see that being the reason Sherman looked bad last season.
So you're saying that's definitely the reason?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's exactly what I just said. And that, and look, he's on the trading block for a reason. And at first we thought the reason was Seattle's looking to trade him. That it came from the team. And I thought that makes perfect sense because they probably know what the rest of the league doesn't quite know for sure yet. And that is whether the knee was a huge factor or not. And if they feel, reading between the lines, you could think, well, they feel it probably wasn't a huge factor, and that they just think he's 28 and he's starting to slow down ever so slightly, and he's one of those guys that if he loses 5% of his game, he essentially loses 20% of his game, just the way it's built. And so they're going to trade him now while his value is still high. But then we hear that Sherman's the one who initiated the trade talks, and I don't know what to make of that. I don't know. First of all, we don't know if that's true. And second of all, if it is true, and Seattle grants his request to initiate trade talks with other teams, what do we make of that? Because I have to believe if Sherman had gone to John Schneider and Pete Carroll 5 years ago, or even, let's say, 3 years ago when he's 25 years old, they would have said, oh, Rich, you want to be traded? Oh, that's too bad. You're not going anywhere.
Yeah, you know, the only thing I can think of, if that is true, and we have no confirmation that's true, I mean, he has 2 years left on his deal. He's, you know, pretty, what does he make? He's 11.4 this year and $11 million next year. So that's, you know, that's a pretty good bargain for a top cornerback at this point. But, so, you know, maybe he said, I want to get paid one more time. The way this is scheduling out, maybe I don't get paid one more time, so I'd rather go somewhere else.
Well, that's, but if he goes somewhere again, else, he has the same contract still, though. His contract gets traded with him.
But he could sort of say, well, let's talk about what we're going to put on top of this now. Because okay. The Seahawks might have said, hey, we're not doing anything about it because you're going to be, you know, when this is up after 2018, he'll be, what, 31 at that point?
He'll be 30. And it's pretty much after 2017, because if they cut him in 2018, the dead money is negligible. If they cut him now, then it destroys part of their salary cap. So you can't just cut him now. But after this season, you can cut him, and it's not going to hurt their salary cap.
Yeah, but they wouldn't. I mean, I don't want to talk like it's a foregone conclusion that they can get rid of him after this season, but I don't know if there's any reason to think that they would. I mean,
if he plays like he did last year, they'll get rid of him after this season, no question.
Like he played last year?
Yeah. He was not an $11 million a year cornerback last season. And if he does that again this year, if he plays at that same level, and if that's true, he probably will play at a level below it because it means he's on the decline. Mm-hmm. I think they would get rid of him in a heartbeat. That was the whole reason I wrote the article. I think this is Sherman's make or break year in Seattle. If he even stays on the team.
Interesting. I'm not totally on board with you, Andy, but I'll keep an open mind.
Well, let's remove the name from it, because Sherman's such a polarizing name and he's such a figure. Let's just say you've got a cornerback who is 29 years old and the passer rating against him, I don't know what it was last season. Let's say it's 80, let's say it's 95. Let's say teams had a lot of success throwing at this guy all year long, and he has a very distinct weakness, which is that he can't cover in-breaking routes anymore. And anytime you have a corner with a distinct weakness, now teams know exactly how to go at you. Would you want to pay that guy $11 million a season at age 30 after he struggled at age 29?
I'd think about it. I probably wouldn't think about it.
Well, the other part of this, Gary, is they don't have depth at corner right now, and they've always had guys in the works, and they really just, you know, Deshaun Chedd, who I thought was tremendous last season, he hurt his knee in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And Nico Thorpe's their backup cornerback. He's a longer body guy, so he fits what they want to do. But Nico Thorpe's basically a journeyman, and we might not even remember his name in 2 years from now. So regardless of how they view Sherman, they need a corner in this draft. And the neat part about it is, because of the way they use their corners, they don't necessarily need the most athletic man-to-man guy, so they could probably find their corners in the middle rounds if they want to.
Do you think, you know, we talked about this a lot last season, especially with the Seahawks and the Falcons, how they sort of moved away from those cover three looks and played more man. Do you think that would motivate the Seahawks to go maybe with a round one corner? Maybe go with someone who could be a little more of a pure man guy.
If that is truly in their long term plans to play more man to man, and I don't know if it is or not. I do know that a lot of the other cover three teams, including Atlanta, who's coached by Seattle's former coordinator, Dan Quinn, they also played more man-to-man. And so you wonder if teams feel that the league has come up with too many ways to attack cover three zone, which is what Seattle's always been. That's been their mm-hmm. foundation. And if Seattle drafts a corner in round one or even round two this year, Gary, and it's an athletic guy, then that would be, it wouldn't make headlines, but it should. That would be very big news, because that would represent a shift in philosophy from one of the marquee defenses this year. And I'll be real interested to see that, because yes, they played a lot more man coverage last season, which also doesn't bode well for Sherman, by the way, not if he's struggling on in-breaking routes or even change of direction routes. And we'll find out if they are going to do that long term or not.
Yeah. Well, I will stay cautiously optimistic on Sherman and chalk it up to the knee injury last year, slowing him down too much. But
yeah, I hope that's the case. You don't want to see guys, whether you like him or not, and you know, we kind of like him at MMQB because we've worked with him and he's been great with us. Mm-hmm. But you know, so whether you like him personally or not, you want to see figures like that get the max out of their ability and their talent. And if he washes up at 29 years old, that would be a little bit disappointing.
Yeah, but hey, 3 years ago, if you said Darrell Revis would be out of the league after 2016, I think you would have raised some eyebrows, but here we are. You know, cornerback, it's so heavily based on what you can do athletically. It's tough to be a, I don't know, tough to be a cagey veteran cornerback and sort of get by once the movement skills are gone.
Yep, I agree. And that's why, like, Terrence Newman is the guy that shocks me. He's been doing it for 5 years. He's been shocking me every year because you think his legs have to go. At cornerback, you're totally reactive to the guy you're guarding, which that's why it takes so much more athleticism. You have to do what a receiver does, but you don't know what he's going to do. And you don't see a lot of old cornerbacks. You're absolutely right. The ones that do tend to be in zone schemes, and that's where Newman's played a lot.
Well, let's stay in the NFC West, and I want to talk about a guy who, I don't know, he kind of moved like he was 30-something years old and on decline last year. Todd Gurley had to be the most disappointing player in the league last year, because not only did he have the promising rookie year, but the rookie year came off of a year where he was coming off the torn ACL. So you figure that was sort of a transition year, getting confidence back in the knee, and then he comes back year two, and you have a full-fledged star. And early in the year, I was thinking, you know, if you put Todd Gurley behind the Cowboys line and put Ezekiel Elliott behind the Rams line, you're totally swapping their fortunes here. We'd be saying Todd Gurley's generational talent and, oh, Ezekiel Elliott, what a disappointment. But Gurley just wasn't very good last year.
He wasn't. And I was with you on that. I thought early in the season his numbers weren't there, and I thought, okay, you know, it'll take care of itself. And a lot of people, anytime a running back, especially a dynamic young one, takes a step back, we assume the offensive line wasn't very good. And with the Los Angeles Rams, it was exactly true. That offensive line, they could not run basic inside zone or duo blocks, meaning it's the most basic run we just talked about with the Giants, the most basic run in football. Two double teams inside, someone works off the double teams and up to the linebacker, and the running back just runs behind those bulldozers. The Rams could not do that. They couldn't win with two guys against one guy up front.
Yeah.
And if you can't do that, you can't play, because that means you're certainly not athletic enough to run outside zone. You're not going to be athletic enough to do pull blockers or moving pieces. And so that was the Rams' issue, and Gurley struggled behind that. But then as the season went on, the Rams there were times they weren't awful every single snap. There were also a lot of cases, and it got worse as the season progressed. There were a lot of cases where Gurley was leaving yards on the field. He wasn't hitting the holes that were there. It's the same thing Jeremy Hill had an issue with in his second season in Cincinnati. And I don't know what gets into – nobody knows this – what gets into a running back's mind when that happens. And I could see if you're Gurley and you're getting hit again and again, the holes aren't forming – something shifts within you and it changes your approach to the game. It changes your confidence, whatever it is. But by the end of the year, it was a 50-50 blame to go around. The line was bad, but Gurley was also not nearly as good.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that was thrown out there, he played about 20 pounds lighter last year. I mean, do you think that had any impact on basically his physical skills?
Was he that much lighter? I didn't notice he was that much lighter.
I thought he had said he had dropped 20 pounds. As you give this answer, I'll confirm that.
His style of play isn't based much on weight. Like, if you'd asked me that about Jeremy Hill, going back to the other sophomore slump running back, I would say, yeah, that's definitely a factor. because Hill has very good feet, but he's also he's at his best when he can square up and use his downhill momentum. Gurley, where he is special when he looks good, is he has an almost imperceptible change of direction ability. He's the most nuanced runner in the league when it comes to wiggle and agility and maintaining his downhill movement off of that. And so that's really not a powerhouse weight kind of thing. Like, I would think, if anything, losing weight would make you better at that.
Yeah. Yeah, he supposedly lost about 15 pounds last year. He went from 230 to about 215.
Interesting. The other thing you wonder about, and some people, you hear whispers about this around the league a little bit, is Gurley was in St. Louis as a rookie, and he was in Los Angeles as a sophomore, and he was almost a superstar status when he joined Los Angeles, when he went to Los Angeles. And did that factor in? What kind of, you know, did the Hollywood lifestyle appear a little bit onto the equation?
Yeah. Well, they have they brought in Andrew Whitworth. They're shuffling that offensive line a little bit schematically. Obviously, Sean McVay and Matt LaFleur are in there. They brought Aaron Cromer in there to coach the offensive line from Buffalo. How much different do you expect this scheme to look next year?
It's hard to answer that, because what happened with Rob Boris, their offensive coordinator last year, he was a little inexperienced. I think he would admit that. So you didn't always get a full sense of what they were trying to do. But I think the biggest reason for that is because they were so deficient at so many positions that Boris's hands were tied. I think we're going to have that issue a little bit with McVay. Their receiving core right now is not good enough to give McVay the full scale of his offense. And the offensive line is better, and Cromer's a good old line coach. That if it's Aaron Cromer there, and especially when you put him with McVay, it means it's going to be a zone-blocking offensive line, mm-hmm. a very aggressive one. So Bill Callahan, who was the O-line coach in Washington, that's who McVay's worked with, and he learned a lot. They had a great relationship. Callahan's a little bit more of a finesse zone-blocking type approach. Cromer's more of an attitude zone-blocking type approach, which would fit Los Angeles and what they want to do, but you still have to have athletes to do that, especially at the inside positions, guard, center, and I'm not sure they've got that. So I don't know how much different the Rams will look. They'll look different, but they're not going to be able to do everything they want to do this season, because they can't overhaul 8 or 9 starters on offense in 1 year.
Yeah, I mean, they obviously don't have a first-round pick either because of the golf trade up a year ago, so...
They need at least 2 new wide receivers and probably 3, because Tavon Austin's a gadget player and they'll use him fine, but he's not a prototypical starting receiver. Yeah. Robert Woods is a possession guy and probably a number 3. So we don't have any outside wide receivers at all. Who are those guys? And by the way, we don't know much about our tight ends either. Tyler Higbee, their 4th-round pick last year, is probably the leader in the clubhouse to start there, and he's a mystery.
Yeah. I'm a little bummed they didn't chase... I'm fine with Robert Woods, whatever, but, you know, considering how little, Alshon Jeffrey and Terrell Pryor signed for, I was a little bummed they didn't chase one of those guys.
Yeah, or DeSean Jackson, because I would believe Jackson would have followed McVay to Los Angeles if they'd wanted him. So they didn't want DeSean Jackson. It's reading between the lines. I'm just guessing at that. And so that's interesting, because that's a guy who did know the system and still has his speed. And maybe it's about him personally. You know, what kind of effort do you get? Can we trust everything he does? I don't know. But the fact that they didn't go after those guys that you just mentioned – that tells you maybe they've taken the long view on this. Maybe they're even saying, we don't know who's going to be on this team after this year. Before we sign anybody to any big-time money, let's see what we got and what we can keep for 2018, because we're going to want to build around that.
Yeah. Yeah, like we said a couple weeks ago. I think we said it on the show a couple weeks ago. Only one guy on this team that is older than Sean McVay, and that is Andrew Whitworth. Are you not shocked by that stat, Andy?
That Whitworth stat? Well, I mean, you just said we said it on the show a few weeks ago.
Did we? I couldn't remember if I said it on the show or if I just called you at 3 a.m. and said, Andy, you're not going to believe this.
I think what we did, now that I recall, because I wrote about it a few days later and my researchers caught me on it and said, hey, you know, that's nice, but it's Whitworth. I said nobody was older than McVay. I think we talked about the Whitworth signing, and then proceeded to say nobody on the Rams is older than McVay, which would be true if without the Whitworth signing, but we hadn't kind of processed Whitworth onto the roster in our mind yet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they brought in they have Connor Barwin too. Connor Barwin might be.
Oh, I'm sure he's. Well, maybe not. Yeah, 86. McVay's 31, a young 31, turned 31 in January. Barwin's 30.
Nope, Barwin's so, 30. Yep. So
McVay's the man in charge.
There you go.
Yep. I wonder what the record is for fewest number of players older than a head coach. I would assume the Rams are setting it now with one.
There you go. We'll have to look at the old Lane Kiffin roster, see how that shaped up with the Raiders. Andy, I'm just going to throw this out there now because I'm not sure. We'll talk about it as the week goes on, but I was thinking maybe next week we do a mailbag show in the lead-up to the draft and people can send their draft questions and their draft need questions and whatever. If you want to ask us who you think is going to get drafted somewhere, we'll guess. I'll guess. You don't have to guess, Andy, but... maybe we'll do a mailbag, and then we'll do a review show. Maybe we'll put it out a little bit early. We'll have to talk to Lou about that. Now I'm just planning our schedule on our show, which
yeah,
is
no,
kind
I,
of
I'm,
foolish.
I'm
but...
wondering if we are still recording, in fact. This sounds like our post-show kind of discussion.
We'll... but we're never this decisive. We're all just like, oh, what do you want to do?
Yeah, because we have a clock ticking on us right now. I like the mail. Let's look at one show at a time, right? Take the Belichick approach. I like the mailbag idea. So let's ask for mailbag questions because we get some really good ones too. You could argue that the mailbag, our mailbag listeners, our fans there, they do a better job of planning the shows than we do.
Oh, I don't even think it's an argument. I think they just do. I think our mailbag shows are the best. So send your mailbag questions. This will be the third one of the offseason. Andy underscore Benoit, ggrambling underscore SI. You can also get us on Facebook. We're both on Facebook. You can write really long there, but don't write too long because Andy gets irritated with that. And talkback at the mmqb.com. You can email there. Just put podcast somewhere in your email so it shows up when I do a little search for it. So there you go.
Twitter's good gets good mailbag too. Did you say that?
Twitter, yeah,
did?
I said the Twitter. All that right, was the first. I didn't call it Twitter, but Andy underscore Benoit and G yep. Rambling underscore SI. Those are not our given Christian names, but those are our Twitter handles. So you can write in there. But I think we're gonna wrap it up for this week right now. Thank you, as always, to producer Lou Pellegrino. We miss Matt Havia, but we love Lou just as much now, and now we've forgotten all about Matt. And also Chris Basil doing the editing on this, mastering it, making it sound good. All those guys at Digital Media, so good to us. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. You really are the best. We have the backup of mailbag questions. We'll go through those, but send new ones. They're great. And not to mention, we just love hearing from you. So if you just want to drop something in and say hello or criticize, do it. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. Lots of draft stuff there. He and Emily know what they're talking about. The MMQB podcast with Peter King. He also knows what he's talking about, but not as much. The MMQB 10 Things podcast. Get any of those wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.